Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Speech, language, and swallowing disorders can result from a variety of causes, including things like brain injury, hearing loss, developmental delays, cleft palate, and believe it or not, even emotional issues. On Line One today, we're going to discuss the work of speech-language pathologists in helping diagnose and treat disorders of speech, language, and swallowing. Our guests are Molly Rutledge. She's a speech-language pathologist at a local hospital, and Meredith Mosqueda, who is also a speech-language pathologist in a school here in Anchorage. And I feel the need for transparency, even when and we're in an era where it seems that reality and facts sometimes are not so pertinent, but I feel obligated to mention that Meredith Mosqueda was once Meredith Woodard prior to her marriage. So if I slip up on her name, listeners can understand that. Welcome to both of you. It's great to have, I think it's the first time we've had anybody with speech-language therapy, speech-language pathologist with us. So it's a pleasure.
Great.
Thanks
for having us.
Yeah.
Let me remind listeners, there is a couple of ways that you can get in touch with us. You can reach us during the next hour with your questions and comments by calling us locally. If you're in Anchorage, that number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We have an email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. You have to spell line one out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. And finally, a number I'll give a couple of times, the toll-free number for is 1-888-353-5752. So I like to start, especially with people involved in the healthcare issues or healthcare community, to tell us a little bit about training. So if one or both of you would like to kind of tell us what it takes to get into a degree in speech-language therapy, and then we'll kind of talk about what you do individually after that.
Great. Well, this is Molly, and yes, thanks again for having us today. I attended the University of Kansas, where I sought my undergraduate degree, which was a Bachelor of Arts in Communications Sciences and Disorders, and then that is typically followed by a two-year master's program, again, in Communication Sciences and Disorders. So really, the schooling part involves that undergraduate and graduate degree. Mm-hmm. And then following that, there's something called your clinical fellowship year, and you'll often hear it called a CFY. And it's actually a transition period between being a student enrolled in a program and then being an independent provider in speech-language pathology. And that CFY is typically 36 weeks and equates to about 1,260 hours before you're...
So I relate that in my mind to an internship and residency. It's on the job training with some supervision so that you get some hands-on, although that may be happening during your regular training as well. And that is required in this country to get certification?
That's correct, mm-hmm. Yes. And you have a supervisor that is uh-huh. right there with you during that time. So.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Then, Meredith, usually there's some kind of test.
Well, yeah, there's a test. it's a big test, I'm blanking on the name of that test.
The praxis.
Yes. Yes. I kind of have blocked that. Exactly. It was a very stressful time.
Yes.
But yeah, you need to get a passing score on the praxis, and that really is a global assessment of your knowledge in speech language pathology. That is on top of the clinical fellowship and your master's degree. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So all speech therapists have to go through this. They all have a master's degree. They all have some, I forget what you call it, internship-like situation. Then you have to take this test, and then you are fully licensed to do things. And you, as I recall, the test is a little bit after you're out working for a while.
I mean, it depends. Okay. I think for my graduate program, it was part of what I needed to graduate. I needed to do it before I graduated. And okay. that might be how it is for a lot of different programs. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I believe I took it before I started in my first position with my CFY.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okie doke. And another little bit of housekeeping. I have introduced you all as speech language pathologists, but I've maybe already used the term speech therapist because that's what I do every day, use that term. What's the difference?
there's not really a big difference, to okay. be quite honest. I think speech-language pathologist really gives a good title to everything that we deal with and what is involved in communicating speech and language. And I don't know.
I agree. Yeah. And sometimes you'll even hear SLP, which is short for speech-language pathologist. Mm-hmm. Right.
So now you graduate, you got your degree, you pass your praxis, you're out there in the real world. What are you doing? What are the different opportunities? What are the different assignments, different kinds of activities that speech-language pathologists do?
Well, I'll speak a little bit about how my journey's been so far. So I started in the public schools when I finished my master's degree, which was about 13 years ago. And then I transitioned to what's called early intervention, and that is a opportunity to provide services to children ages birth to 3 in their home setting, which could also be any natural setting. So it might be their home, but it also might be their daycare or a foster care placement, or it can be a variety of places, but usually a natural setting for the children. And then I've also provided services in a hospital setting, which is where I am currently. And I believe Meredith is in the schools.
So. I am in the schools, yes. And Molly already mentioned that the school setting is possible for us, but the other settings could be private practice and a private clinic. Mm-hmm. And you can also be a teacher. You can go further past the master's degree and receive a doctorate in speech-language pathology and conduct research and teach others who are seeking this job.
All right. So let me give our how to get in touch with us if individuals listening today have questions or comments one more time, and then we'll get into some of the details of speech and language. In Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8433, 550-8433. Call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, or you can email us at lineone@alaskapublic.org. We'd like to have any questions you have or comments. If you're sitting there worried about your child, or you're worried about someone who's older who may have had some head injury or some kind of problem with their speech or language, this would be a good time to get some professional advice. All right. So people who listen to this program know I often try to point out that we now are acutely aware that the first couple of years of life, some people will say the first 1,000 days, and that means the first 2 years of life plus the time that a woman is pregnant, are formative. We're getting 80% of our adult head size, our heads growing because not because cells in our brain are getting bigger and not because we're getting more cells, but because the brain is beginning to make interactions and cells with each other through dendrites, and that's what's causing that brain to get larger. And those dendrites are being pushed along and encouraged by stimulation. So important period of time for the rest of our life is now correlated with this early period of life. Now, take me back to what's going on with speech and language and hearing and so forth, and why that's so critical in this first couple of years.
I think you mentioned, that it can even be before an infant is actually born. And so what we know is that hearing can be possible in the womb, and not only hearing, but language development. There's swallowing development, feeding disorders. Those are all things, of course, that as SLPs we pay attention to, and those things are feeding development, swallowing, communication, all of those are being developed in utero. So it's very important to be aware of those things even prenatally. And so you'll hear often there's recommendations to expose your child to your voice as if you're expecting, and the father's voice, if that's a possibility, or anyone that may be taking care of that infant, it may be beneficial for them to, the more talking that they hear prenatally, the better. But beyond that, there's many things that we can do to promote the language even after birth.
So. How do we know babies can hear in utero?
Well, I correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there have been some tests that have been able to kind of look at the movement of babies within the womb and to see if there are any physical expressions that are happening after hearing language. Right. Right. And also heartbeat, mm-hmm. I think, is also a big one that shows us when something is being inputted and changing what the baby is hearing.
Mm-hmm. I've always thought it makes sense to me. I mean, you can just tell how a baby's response is to sound mm-hmm. and correlate that. That another kind of indirect evidence is that babies almost always prefer a woman's voice to a man's voice after birth. And there's been studies where moms and dads or men and women are holding babies in between them, and they'll turn their head to the mother almost 80 or 90% of the time. And then I remember a study where they looked at the inflection of the baby's cry with German babies and French babies, and there were definitely differences suggesting that the quality of the cry was reflected on what they'd heard in utero. Have you all heard that kind of stuff?
Mm-hmm. I have. Mm-hmm. And I do, you know, I do in my own practice do see that the babies often recognize their mother's voices very, very soon. After delivery.
So I guess a corollary would be that if babies can't hear early in life, that's not so good.
Correct.
What happens if babies can't hear or the quality of the hearing is not up to snuff?
Well, I think they're not getting that input and that model of language and speech as early. And, you know, we've heard that babies' brains are like sponges. They are constantly listening and constantly learning these behaviors that are around them. And if you don't have access to that auditory input, it can affect how they would express themselves later on. I think that's...
My understanding is if I get back to this model of the brain where the dendrites are beginning to express themselves and move and make actual physical circuits, that if language and vision, those parts of the brain are not adequately stimulated, that there's really a critical point after which that doesn't happen. In a sense, the body says, I'm wasting energy, and a huge portion of our energy early in life goes to our brain, and the body will prune away those neurons, and so later, even if we were to somehow make a child hear, they would not hear the same, and as a consequence, language would not be the same.
That's correct.
So a baby who doesn't hear correctly and is not discovered early would lead to some lifelong difficulties.
Correct. And I think that's, you know, why it's so important that we have these early newborn hearing screenings within our hospitals. And I think we've made great advancements of that, even since I've been in the professional field. But certainly something that I know as a caregiver myself, too, that is very critical to pay attention to when your baby is just born and making sure that hearing screening's mm-hmm. being done, mm-hmm. that you know the results and you know that what those results mean. So...
And the earlier it's recognized that there may be a problem, the better.
Correct.
And it's reassuring that the hearing screen is normal at birth, but it does not guarantee that it'll continue to be normal.
Correct. That's right.
You're not hearing specialists, and this just popped into my mind, and we want to talk about how to stimulate infants' language development, but what might be signs that hearing is not okay? Is that a fair thing to mention, even after you've had a normal hearing screen at birth?
Sure. I think that goes along with what, you know, how you're asking ways that we can promote language early on. And I think if we're for infants, if we're noticing maybe they're not turning towards a sound or they're not startling to a loud noise, or again, as they're getting a few months older, if they're not cooing, they're not babbling, they may not be doing a responsive smile, anything like, or to a laugh or giggle, anything to that effect may mean that the hearing could be impaired.
Mm-hmm. Meredith, what about stimulating language in early childhood? Are there very well agreed upon things that might help?
Well, I think the biggest thing is talking to your child. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a great model for, you know, how to communicate. I think another thing that we can do as caregivers is also having that opportunity to play with your child and having mm-hmm. that child have opportunities to play with other children. Mm-hmm. So they're getting different experiences and generalizing their skills and learning something new from somebody else, because that social part of language is critical. I mean, it's especially in early development.
What about how you talk to a child? This is where I'm a little confused. Is do you coo and babble and, you know, baby talk, or is it recommended, or do we know for sure whether just talk to them like any other child that you might want to talk about and tell them how the weather's been and how the day is going while you're changing the diaper?
Right. There, you know, this is where it's been interesting to talk with Meredith, because she's finished her graduate program more recently than I have. And I know when I went through graduate school, one of the strategies that we used was using very short phrases with mm-hmm. infants and toddlers. So mm-hmm. If you're going to be working on just one word phrases, the parents would model the one word phrase to the child. Or if you're going to be working on two word phrases, the parent would model the two word phrases. But I recently read an article in one of my journals that's a recommendation that they're stepping a little bit away from, and now they are going back to really modeling a complete sentence. It doesn't have to be, as far as all the articles of the sentence do not have to be exact, but from going to say "mommy shoe," now their recommendation is to say "mommy puts shoe on," mm-hmm. or just mm-hmm. adding those other words in. So that's been, I've actually am looking more into that and wanting to find more information, because right. that is very different from what I was right. taught when I went through school.
Yeah, well, they actually are calling that, you know, that cooing and that high intonation as motherese. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'll ask you about Spanish in a second.
Yeah.
Motherese,
okay. And they are. It's definitely they are starting to really recommend that, you know, you are being a little bit more exaggerated when you're talking to your baby, and really taking that turn taking as well is so important for the baby in whether it be hide and seek or whether it would be peekaboo or you know, if the baby does anything vocalizing, that you're responding, so that they are understanding that behavior and that turn and take of when I say something, something happens. So right. that's really important.
Mm-hmm. It's a response. It's this behavior modification. So if a mother is talking to a baby, and then when the baby does something back and the mother does nothing, then that would not be thought of as a very helpful thing to develop speech, because the baby's not getting any feedback.
I mean, yeah, I think it's always important to be able to respond mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. giving and showing that model.
Yeah, I'm saying that because of studies I see in child development where they give examples of a mother who does not respond with any facial anything back mm-hmm. when they're talking to a baby, and it really leads to stress in the baby. And so we're, again, getting to this point where there's a lot going on between an infant and his environment in those first couple of years. Other than just learning how to talk and learning how to do this, we're learning what happens when they do this, what happens mm-hmm. when I do that, mm-hmm. what happens when a man and a woman are together. Are they yelling at each other? Are they not? This tells us how the world works mm-hmm. and socially, as well as we're learning our physical things. So that brings me to the Spanish or the multiple language question. Is what about having families where they're are two or maybe three languages spoken in the family, in the household? Is that good, bad? We don't know.
Well, the literature is saying that speaking multiple languages is a good thing. Restricting your child from hearing a language or practicing a language at home or in the school is not necessarily the best way. I mean, especially with language disorders, if a child is showing difficulty in one language but not showing difficulty in another language, that doesn't necessarily mean that that they have a language disorder. I think if they're having difficulties in both languages, then that would be mm-hmm. considered a language disorder. And mm-hmm. Encouraging both languages at home is, I think, really important for development.
And I might just add that we do know that if you are speaking another language in the home, whoever the speaker, it should be a language that they're comfortable with. So what we mm-hmm. do know is if someone is maybe speaking a language that is their second or third language to their child, that may not be as helpful as speaking their own native language to their child. Does that make mm-hmm. sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's whoever's at home, you want them to be proficient in the language that they are speaking.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. Our topic today is speech and language. We're going to talk about both speech and language, but also some swallowing issues. We've concentrated on early childhood and brain development. We'll eventually get into some adult issues. If you've got questions or comments, here's how you get a hold of us during the next maybe 40 minutes or so right now. Local number 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Another source of language is our screens, TVs, computers, iPads, video games, and so forth. What can we say about the pros and cons of the differences that this may have on language development in children?
That is a very, very good question. And do we ever live in such a virtual time to have children growing up? So I think it's great that we all be aware of, first of all, what even screen time is. And maybe, Dr. Ritter, if you can explain what you mean by screen time.
Yeah, it's the amount of time that a child is sitting in front of a screen that they are interacting with. That's what I mean.
So like a TV or computer,
perhaps
phone.
A computer, phone. Yep, phone, any of those.
Yes,
things.
So we have so much access now to screens. And
yeah, I mean, I guess what I'm getting at specifically, and you can expand on this, but it is, I think there's the conception, there may be the perception is the right word, that if a child is watching a cartoon or watching people speak on TV or on a computer program or something, that they're learning language as efficiently as they might in interacting with another person.
Right. And what we know through research is really that it's that interaction with a live person. So their caregivers, their peers, those are, again, like you were talking about, all the brain wiring that's going on early mm-hmm. and even beyond, you know, those early years. Really, that's critical for their language development and their social skill development. So mm-hmm. Learning these things from videos or from non-familiar sources may not be as helpful to these children.
Why may that not be? What's the reason for that?
Well, you know, I think that could even go back to when we talked about the infants recognizing their own parents' voices right. in their room. Right. So that's going to carry over even to their mm-hmm. language development. So what I've seen and what I know through my own practice is often that child will engage far more readily with a familiar voice than they would from a non-familiar voice. So I know parents might think, oh, they hear that song on the cartoon, and mm-hmm. oh, they really are learning from that cartoon. But right. they, you know, our research just tells us they learn a lot more from that parent or mm-hmm. that whoever that individual is in their home.
Yeah, one thought I have about that is when you're talking to somebody, they're talking back at you, so you're getting some communication. Whereas when you're talking or when you're looking at a screen, there's no feedback coming
right.
back. So it's not the same.
It's not, okay. No. And I think there are some great web developers out there, and they are trying to make some apps
right.
that do things back at the children.
Right.
But again, it's not the same as a human being right there with them. So,
are there some very important milestones in language development that we should talk about? And we're getting close to a break, so if we could do that, and then I'll take a break, and we'll come back and perhaps maybe get into some of the swallowing issues. But what about milestones that you think about if you're seeing children?
So I can talk a little bit about the birth to three, and then maybe Meredith can talk a little bit about those preschool and beyond years. But
sure.
we talked about at birth, looking for some of those pleasure sounds, the cooing and the gooing, the crying for different needs, smiling when they see you. And then it gets a little more advanced with the true babbling and laughing and vocalizing with excitement or displeasure. And then by 1 year, they're starting to have longer babbling strings. So instead of ba-ba, they might say da-da, up, 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 up. It might be a longer string that they're able to put together. And then using gestures now as they're getting closer mm-hmm. to one. So there's these things to kind of look at in an order as they reach that age one. And then from age one to two, you might start to actually hear some true words. So they might say one word together or two words together. They might start to ask really simple questions. And then from age two to three, you'll actually start to hear some two or three word phrases, and you might start to hear some more complex consonant sounds and not so much the babbling of vowels, but actually consonant sounds. And they'll actually start to ask you why, which I know parents love that question, but that's when that typically begins closer mm-hmm. to age three. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. And by 3 years, typically children are about 75% intelligible. So Molly was mentioning the development of different phonemes or those sounds that are in English. And there are some developmental errors that happen as a child is growing and developing. And those are normal to a certain extent. But by 3 years, they should be about 75% intelligible to an unfamiliar listener. So that's someone outside of their family or someone they don't interact with as much. And they'll start to put like three or four words together at 3 to 4. You might start seeing really important grammatical markers. And what I mean by that is that present progressive ing, running, walking. You also see other markers like the possessive s, mommy's coat, or plural s, look at the cats. Really important things in English. Mm-hmm. And they'll start telling stories mm-hmm. about what's going on in their day or maybe something imaginative. It's not going to be a very long, you know, very with lots of interesting details, but they'll start telling stories. And by 4 to 5, they'll start being closer to 90% intelligible to unfamiliar listeners. And they'll still have some sound errors, but that goes on. About age 8 is when all phonemes are typically acquired. So they'll still have some problems pronouncing some sounds. And then you'll start seeing more complex grammar with irregular past tense verbs. He ate, he drank. They'll start following really complex they'll start following directions. Mm-hmm. And by 5, they should be intelligible. You should be able to hear them. They might start, you know, asking about, you know, words. They become aware of language and start asking, what does this word mean? Learning that way. And something else that I haven't mentioned, too, is there's a lot of social development that happens throughout those years, too, of turn-taking and initiating play with others and also joining in play. I think that's a really big part of language development.
All right. Let's go ahead and take our break at this particular time. I want to remind everyone again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take about a one-minute break, and we'll continue to discuss speech and language pathology with Molly Rutledge and Meredith Mosqueda. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are Molly Rutledge and Meredith Mosqueda. Both are speech-language pathologists or speech therapists. We've learned that pretty much means the same thing. Molly works at a local hospital, and Meredith is a school-based language pathologist, a speech-language pathologist. You can email your questions, again, to line1 at Alaska Public Media or alaskapublic.org, our local number 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and the usual warning that if you're listening between 8 and 9 on a Monday evening, that's a rebroadcast that you're listening to, and we won't be able to answer your phone calls or emails. So, Molly, we mentioned at the beginning of the show that you're at a hospital, and so I'm envisioning what you do in a hospital has got to be a lot different than what Meredith does in a school. Tell me a little bit about the differences, and then maybe we'll take one or two of those things and explore them a little better.
Sure. Well, I am in a hospital, and currently I'm in an inpatient pediatric setting. And I would say, you know, something I think that often surprises people is that I'm in a neonatal intensive care unit, and because they might think, well, what is a speech therapist doing in a neonatal intensive care unit? But our work is actually very important in that we help with these babies and their feeding readiness and their ability to feed, again, even when they're preterm. So that's a big job of what I do, a big part of my job and what I do right now. I also do some work inside the pediatric intensive care unit and then also the regular pediatric floor. So my setting's a bit unique in that it is a lot of feeding and not as much direct language and articulation evaluation and treatment, although that does that it's certainly not uncommon to see that, but it's not as common as the feeding and swallowing that I do. And I think some people are surprised even that a speech therapist works with swallowing.
So tell me about that. So you have some prematures in neonatal intensive care, often maybe full term, but maybe often not. And so how do you get involved? What happens?
Right. So something that we know is very critical for feeding development is that babies learn to feed in a comfortable and safe manner. So my role in the neonatal intensive care unit is to really make sure these babies are feeding again, and safely, and that it's an infant-driven model. So by infant-driven, I mean I'm there to really watch that the babies are cueing to feed, that they are the leaders in their feedings, and that as staff, we're seeing those cues that they can give us, because it's very amazing. Even these 32, 33-weekers give a lot of cues, either to feed or to say, no, please don't feed me. So.
And what are those?
Yeah, so those may be signs of disengagement, which could be, you know, closing their eyes, rolling their eyes, turning away from a nipple source, crying, facial grimace. Any of those types of cues are very, very, they're very important to understand, because if we do not pay attention to those cues, what we know through research now is feeding disorders can develop and even last into toddlerhood. Yeah, it's a big part of what I do.
You know, I'm not as familiar with that. I know it's important. I can envision that how children learn to swallow and feed can lead to later problems. And I make the analogy of what we're being told now about our early childhood playing with kids is to let kids set the pace. That it's child-led play is what you want to do with young children. You don't want to go in and assume that this is what you need to learn to do. You let them explore, and that works better. They grow up feeling better about themselves. They don't get frustrated with trying to do things that they don't want to do and that they're not at all prepared to do sometimes.
Yep,
so it's the same idea.
That's right. We're, you know, really getting away from it being a task to really more of a turn-taking experience for the infant.
So the feeding disorders that might develop if this doesn't proceed well are?
Sure. I think a big one is feeding aversion. So what we see is children may, as they start to have I would say, power in their feeding choices, and they're as they're getting older and being able to communicate a little bit more, you may see them actually protesting a certain texture or a certain type of food, or you know, could be a variety of things. But you may start to see some of those some behaviors where they really shut down and do not thrive like you would expect them to.
It's not unusual for mothers to mention that as feeding begins, that textures can be a problem for some babies. And the appropriate response to that should be?
Right. That's a great question. Well, you know, I think that's where our jobs come into play. You know, I think if it's becoming a real struggle, it may be worth having a therapist actually do an evaluation to determine is this a picky eating situation, or is this a true aversion, or is there is it even beyond that, and there may be an allergy. You know, there's things that kind of get outside of our practice too, but we can certainly take a look at those things along with their physician. It's really that's when it begins to get into being a really team approach, which it is in the hospital too, where you know, as a team, you look at what's going on and see if together you can help.
And you mentioned safety about feeding. I guess that gets to swallowing.
That's
and
right.
Discoordinated swallowing. And tell us a little bit more about that and also how you can assess and treat that problem.
Sure.
Or those problems.
Sure. So, but yes, by safety, I mean protecting them from having any sort of dysphagia event. So that in a medical setting, we are concerned a lot about aspiration, because we know that aspiration, which is swallowing into the lungs versus the esophagus, may cause respiratory problems. So as a therapist, what I'm going to do is watch that child feed and see if I'm seeing signs or symptoms of dysphagia, and try to increase the safety of that swallow.
And dysphagia means?
Dysphagia means really trouble swallowing. And that could mean aspiration or not aspiration. That could mean a variety of things, but it really, as a broad term, is difficulty swallowing.
How about older children? In the hospital, we've really concentrated on young kids and development, but there's those listeners who may have school-age children and even adults. Are you involved with adults and older children in the hospital setting, and in what way do you become involved in those children, in those individuals?
Sure. So I do see older children. I currently do not see adults, although I have worked with adults in the hospitals in the past. But most hospitals will have speech-language pathologists that do work with adults. At our hospital, we have those therapists available too. But if I'm going to be seeing an older child, it may be from an injury that I'm seeing them, that their swallowing is impaired. That would be probably the most common reason if it's a later onset type of issue.
They can have strokes, they can have head injuries,
they
can have a lot of the things that adults do, and that begins to affect their nervous system in a way that can affect language as well as swallowing.
Yes.
And that's where speech therapists get involved.
That's right.
I have to ask, because it hits me as I'm not sure of the answer, and I'm sure the listeners may. Where do the occupational therapists, how does that interact with what you're doing? Because I envision occupational therapists also helping with some feeding issues as well.
Yeah, Meredith might have one to answer this too, but it can be very... they can be very close in what we do. In my setting, we actually do not have an occupational therapist on the pediatric unit, so I'm really the one that does the feeding and that piece. But I know in other units or in other settings, occupational therapists work closely with the speech-language pathologist, and I tend to think they do more motor type of activities, but it can be close.
There are some. My experience is limited with feeding in the older students being in a school, but it's my understanding that their occupational therapists can be working on that fine motor of tongue movement as well as the chewing factor, so that pre-swallow phase, those phases that happen before, where the occupational therapist might be more involved.
Yeah, and maybe even fine motor helping to hold the fork or the spoon or hold the cup or those types of things.
Okay. Back to some of the things we were talking about before we moved on to the speech or the swallowing. Meredith, when you were talking about child speech development, you mentioned that there's a phase, if I remember what you're saying, you implied to me between 2 and 4, so where there may be some abnormalities that start happening in speech that often go away with time but may not, and maybe hints of something more. And what came to my mind was stuttering. Mm-hmm. Tell me about stuttering.
Stuttering. So stuttering is a fluency disorder. And what I mean by fluency is that forward flow of speech, whether it might be some disruption in producing a sound, repeating a sound, there might be pauses when trying to get words out. That is stuttering. There typically is a point in the development when stuttering is normal. And I believe that's during the 2.5 to 4 years is when you'll typically start seeing children stuttering. And it's more common in males than it is in females. Sometimes, though, stuttering will persist and it won't naturally recover. Reasons why, we're not sure. And reasons why stuttering is happening, there's a lot of different reasons as to why it might happen, and there's not one reason to really pinpoint. If there are red flags that we speech pathologists look at when we have a child who might have a fluency disorder like stuttering, and some of those red flags might be, my uncle stutters, or, it's hereditary. I think also being a male is also another red flag for us since it's more common. And different types of stuttering can show us that it's a red flag. Something that we like blocks. Blocks are when the word's right on the tip of their tongue, but they're stuck and they can't get it out. That's called a block. And how long the stutter is going can also be an implication as to that this might persist.
By how long, you mean how long it lasts?
How long they are repeating a sound. It could be 3 seconds. It could be 8 seconds. I mean, these really can vary. Mm-hmm. Implication I had it in my head and I forgot, but basically that is what we're looking at. Oh, I remembered. Were the behaviors. Sometimes when a child is stuttering, they might have concomitant behaviors where they're nodding, they're rocking back and forth trying to get it out, they're blinking while mm-hmm. they're stuttering, and they mm-hmm. believe it might have worked once to help them get that word out, but mm-hmm. now it's become a habit to where mm-hmm. they are. Mm-hmm. When they're stuttering, it is.
And so what would you tell a parent whose child is almost 3 and has brief periods of stuttering at the beginning of a sentence, especially when they're excited?
Well, then, I mean, it seems like that would be pretty common with all mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. kids around that age. Mm-hmm. I think...
Should they draw attention to it?
I mean, I would say if it's happening at other times, mm-hmm. then that might mm-hmm. need to have more attention, but I think mm-hmm. I don't have any kids, so I can't. Yeah,
I think something you and I talked about before the program is modeling that. So that one thing we can do is model a slow rate of speech, and mm-hmm. so I think about that. You know, I do that myself. I even as a clinician and as a parent, I catch myself speaking fast at times and mm-hmm. realize that. Well, no wonder they're getting excited. Right. I'm speaking excitedly. So I think that's really a tool that we can teach people yeah. to try first and then see how that goes. And
I would just think it would be normal to kind of just settle it down, not draw attention to it, not make a big deal out of it. Yeah. You don't want to make them self-conscious about it, which emotionally may cause this to get worse.
Right.
Meredith, you're in a school. Mm-hmm. What's your day like? We talked about what Molly's doing. What's your day?
Well, I think like Molly, I'm providing therapy every day. It's just different kinds of therapy. I see a lot of different speech and language disorders in the school setting, and They can stuttering can be one of those disorders that I see. I'm working with that student one-on-one. I also see students with articulation or speech sound disorders. They are not very intelligible, not because they don't understand language, but because that execution of speech is limited by either their articulators are not in the right spot, and they just need teaching as to where to put the tongue, or whether to keep the jaw closed or the jaw open for certain sounds. I also am working with students who have language needs. So they have a really hard time following directions. They have a really hard time answering questions. They have some expressive language needs. Their grammar might not be developmentally there. They might have a really hard time being understood by others because their word order is mixed up, or they also might have difficulties with being able to describe something with accurate, specific vocabulary. There's a lot of language is such a broad and wonderful category, I get to work on a lot of different things in the language realm, and it's really great. I love working with kids with language problems.
So. I got distracted for just a second reading a couple of emails that came in. I happen to know that some of your kids you see are autistic. Did you mention that or not?
No. Okay. But yeah, a large majority of the kids I see do have a diagnosis of autism.
Okay. I want to come back to autism because it's a very important issue in today's culture in the United States and our society. But I do have two emails that came in, and they both relate to tongue tie. And this one is my middle child just turned 3. She has a marked tongue tie at birth, which was cut with a laser 2 days. She now has some letters that she does not say correctly and that her dentist has noticed that the frenulum has regrown somewhat. Obviously, children learn how to pronounce their letters at different rates. At what point should we seek help from a speech-language pathologist for pronunciation? So this is a 3-year-old. The tongue tie is now getting to be a big issue, and there was another text about this. What we're talking about is that thing called a frenulum underneath people's tongues, that if you open your mouth and put your tongue on the top of your mouth, you see this tissue that connects your tongue to the bottom of your mouth. But also there's a maxillary frenulum, one just above your teeth. So if you push your upper lip open, there's often a connection of tissue that's like that tongue frenulum that connects down between your middle two teeth. So those are two frenulums that people are talking about. So this lady is asking about, my daughter got her lingual, and I think she's talking about her tongue frenulum cut. It may have gotten a little bit tighter again. She's still having some articulation problems. Could it be this doggone frenulum and tongue tie is causing the problem?
Right. And I feel, it definitely could be. And going to a speech language pathologist may be able to get to look at more characteristics of the child's speech and to be able to see if it actually is the frenulum or if the errors that she has are normal, typical developing. So a speech-language pathologist would give a really good...
So that age, there's a lot of...
Yeah.
Hard-to-understand speech going on.
Yeah.
So my understanding here, this is time to tell me you're wrong... is that if you can get your tongue past your teeth, or at least past your lips, and touch your tongue to the top of your palate, you should not have any problems with tongue ties. It's causing language or articulation issues.
Well,
stop. Or this, you got to get your tongue out.
Right. There's those lingual dental sounds that require your tongue to come in contact with your teeth. And those are like your T's, your D's, your N's. So there are certain sounds, which is why listener may be able to seek that and tease that out a little bit with an SLP because it can be tricky. And as Meredith said, there's still a lot of sound development happening at age 3. So that you would really want to know if those errors might just be developmental and not related to structure.
Right.
So
right.
It's a great question.
Yeah.
Have you two seen people with such tongue ties that it affects their speech development?
Oh, well, I haven't had that experience yet, but I know that tongue tie can affect swallowing mm-hmm. at some point. So
that's right. So, you know, it's something that I see fairly common in the neonatal intensive care unit, even the newborn nursery. Mm-hmm. And the early signs would be that a baby's having trouble latching, whether mm-hmm. it's to a breast or bottle. So that's one of the first things that we would look at to see, well, what's going on.
So that was the source, I think, of the other email, and one that pediatricians are faced with a lot now. We've suddenly gotten very interested in breastfeeding and tongue ties, particularly the lingual for the one under the tongue, although the one above on the mm-hmm. on the upper tape is now another issue. This just gets difficult for me because lactation consultants will often appear to say that if you latch well, breastfeeding should not be painful. I'm still struggling to find the mother who says breastfeeding not painful. So if everybody has pain, then we start looking for reasons for that when there may not be any reason for that. And how do you measure a tight lingual frenulum that's not? So what I've come to do is it depends. I mean, so I give it that it hurts and it's a little discomforting at the beginning. I look at frenulum on all the babies. I put my little finger in the mouth of all babies and have them suck on it so I get a feeling for what they're doing with their tongue. And then if that lingual frenulum is a little bit bothering, I say I'd like to give it a couple of days because I'm basically a non-invasive physician. I don't want to cut that frenulum, which is not a big deal, but I don't want to do anything. I don't have to. There are things, bad things can happen when you start messing around with nature. So that's my philosophy. What do you have to say about that?
I don't think you're unlike other physicians out there that I've had the opportunity to work with. You know, I think it is a feeding issue, especially for an infant, it can be very beneficial for a lactation consultant. And again, this is kind of going back to a team approach and an SLP and the physician to really work together on this to see what the next step would be. So another thing to watch for, I don't know if we mentioned this, but when the child extends their tongue to see if there's an indent mm-hmm. kind of, they might make like what we call a heart shape anterior presentation. So that's something to really look for.
That's a really tethered, that you get into that. It's not common, but you see that.
You do see that.
That would get my attention.
Right. Yes. I think it's not something to just write off, of course. You want to make sure that you're really looking at this closely because it can impact feeding and it can impact that breastfeeding relationship. So using all your professionals that are available to you is recommended.
All right. So we only have a couple of minutes, maybe 4 or 5 minutes left. And we have a question about let's do this one first, then, because I want to get to the autism question because I think it's an important issue. But the question is, what's the most prevalent diagnosis for school-age children? I think what they're asking is, what's the most common problem school-age kids are having with language that speech-language pathologists would be dealing with? How would you answer that question? What would come to your mind first?
I think articulation is a huge one. I think that's the one that impacts intelligibility. I see that a lot.
Yeah. So it's fab instead of thad.
That's correct.
That's one that I used to be called that in first grade. That's why I remember that one. That's why I remember THs or some of the later sounds.
They are. Yeah.
Yes.
And think about, a lot of first graders are missing those front teeth. Yeah. So that is a hard sound to
I
say.
I know. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So I see a lot of that.
So that would be the most common thing is clarity of speech, usually related to articulation.
I think so. Mm-hmm. In my setting, I see a lot of it.
And the prognosis for that is?
Prognosis.
Yeah. What's the likelihood you can fix that?
Well, I mean, I can fix it. I mean, speech pathologists can fix that.
So that's the outcome is pretty good if they get approached at an early enough age, I would guess.
Articulation is a big one where you have got to practice a lot. It's like learning an instrument or learning a new skill. You're breaking a habit, essentially, to learn these new skills. And that requires a lot of involvement of the the parents as well as the speech pathologists and even the teachers in the school system to be able to know, hey, this is what this child is working on, and even having the child understand what they are working on, because that self-awareness is huge to making goals.
You gave me the opportunity. I got to take this opportunity. Okay. So back to the brain and how we're learning. We're setting up physical circuits and so forth. That helps everybody understand why this is critical. But it's also important to understand why the brain's such a good learning organ and such a terrible unlearning organ. You can't unlearn how to ride a bike. So it's harder to unlearn articulation issues the longer they've been gone on. Mm-hmm. So that's what one of the points here is about early learning and early activity. Just like learning how to play baseball right early in life.
Right, and that's where it gets tricky because, as we mentioned before, there are those natural developmental errors. And I think there's a lot of back and forth between speech pathologists as to, well, the R is developed later on, so should I really be working on the R at age 3? And that's every speech pathologist's discretion. That's what they need to figure out and what, you know, that's a tough one.
All right, so we are now 55 minutes into this program, and if 2 more minutes, we're going to start hearing music and have to get off this program. But tell me, what's an early worry about autism to a speech-language pathologist? We're not going to get to talk about autism much, but what would get you worried as a speech-language pathologist?
They're not talking. I think that's the huge one, is by age 2. Uh-huh. They're not saying words or, they're just not talking, I think, is a big, big one that we look for.
And by talking, you mean no individual words, no two-word phrases, not even paying attention with eye contact, looking at people. What do you mean?
Eye contact is huge. I mean, they might not be showing eye contact. They probably won't even be saying words. Mm-hmm. They are relying a lot on their environment to speak for them, I would think. There's also that lack of gestures, like Molly was saying earlier in life. They're not pointing, they're not waving.
Yeah, they're not trying to have communication without language either.
Right. Yeah, that's true. And we might see some difficulties with play as well. They might not be playing with others.
The two big things are socialization, which is what you're getting at,
right,
and language development, which are the big hints.
I might add, too, that there may be language that's lost. So they
that
may be
true.
Talking, and then it stops.
That's true.
So sometimes.
Yeah, you know, I hear that a lot, and I guess it happens. But for me as a pediatrician, I don't see that kind. How about you guys? Have you seen that? Where there was clearly not, I remember them saying this, but maybe some video or something that shows language development.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have.
Oh, boy. Yeah. That would be very disturbing
to really see.
It's
very difficult for caregivers.
Yeah.
All right. We are heading towards the end of this. Any last comments? What do you want people to remember about speech-language pathology?
I don't know did we mention that it is Better Hearing and Speech Month? That May is better.
I did not. No.
Yes, maybe we should let listeners know that part. So it is National Better Hearing and Speech Month. So I would encourage anybody with further questions to look at the American Speech Language Hearing Association website, which has a lot of resources for.
Yeah, I mean, we have that link at alaskapublic.org. If you go to our website, and you'll search for the radio programs, you'll find Line 1, and today's program has that link as well. Well, this has been a pleasure. I enjoyed the time I spent with both of you. Thanks for your information.
Thanks so much for having us.
That's great.
So my thanks to Molly Rutledge and Meredith Mosqueda for joining us on the program today. If you want to continue this discussion on speech-language pathology, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link at our website, www.alaskapublic.org, where you'll also find the link to Line 1 archives, and you can listen to prior programs at your convenience. And you also can give us suggestions and thoughts about our program. Next week, we're taking a holiday for Memorial Day, and we'll return the following Monday after Memorial Day with co-host Prentice Pemberton. Why not join him Monday, June 1 at 2 p.m. and repeating that same evening at 9 p.m. on FM 91.1, Alaska Public Media. This is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.